W. Kamau Bell is known for making Americans laugh and think critically about race and politics. He travels the country as the host of United Shades of America, CNN's docu-series on race-based subcultures. And last week, he released his first Netflix special, Private School Negro. In it, Kamau explores everything from raising biracial black daughters in the Trump era to the Berkeley free speech movement. Kamau has been named an ACLU Celebrity Ambassador for Racial Justice, nominated for the NAACP Image Award, and received an Emmy Award for his work. And I am delighted to welcome Kamau here today. Thank you for joining us. Do we have you there, Kamau?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, fantastic. So, Kamau, Berkeley, California is home for you, yes? Is that where you got your start in comedy?
No, I got my start in Chicago, and then I moved out to the Bay Area. Mostly I moved out to the Bay Area for San Francisco because the San Francisco comedy scene was pretty legendary, and I felt like it would be a good place to grow.
Nice. So your work has always been politically progressive. Tell us about Laughter Against the Machine.
It was a group, me and a bunch of other comedians who were sort of political comedians but weren't doing political comedy the way that people normally did political comedy, because we were actually talking about, like, you know, movements of people and activism and things like that, whereas a lot of political comedy before that felt very sort of like sterile. And so we started a comedy collective we called Laughter Against the Machine, because that we knew that would immediately let people know what we were doing.
What is political comedy in your definition, with that in mind, sort of drawing a distinction between the different approaches?
I mean, I think the label of political comedy is one thing. I think all comedy is political, because inherently, as soon as you talk on stage, you're making choices that are political choices, whether you realize it or not. But I think in this country, you know, the tradition of political comedy comes out of, like, you know, Mark Twain and Will Rogers. But I think, you know, and then I think, you know, you get to like Lewis Black or Will Durst, who lives here in San Francisco, where there's sort of a very sort of like talking about the goings-on of Washington, D.C., and which is funny, and I like that stuff. George Carlin did a little bit of that, too. Whereas I feel like when people started labeling me a political comedian, I would be put on political comedy shows, and I would sort of stand out from the other political comics on the show. So I decided I have to come up with a different label for this, and that's when I started saying sociopolitical, because it was like I'm talking about the bigger movements. I'm not necessarily just talking about D.C.,
the world outside of D.C., more to the point, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Your CNN show, United Shades of America, premiered in the spring of 2016 during the presidential primaries. What's it like to have the Trump administration in the background or the foreground of your work?
Well, I mean, I feel like we were pretty lucky, because our first season was during like the last year of Obama. And so I always said to people that the first season was basically the mixtape and the second season was the album. So
right.
We were able to sort of get our legs under us. I think it would have been pretty challenging to hit the ground running into the Obama era, because the show in the Trump era, because the show is about passing the microphone to people who don't get the microphone enough. Last night, our season finale was about the Native Hawaiians and talking about how their land was stolen from them by the United States of America, which, you know, that's a very, you know, it's a statement a lot of people don't want to hear, but it's clearly true from the history. And I think that we had to sort of work up ourselves to be able to tell a story like that.
Oh, a lot of history we don't want to hear. You mentioned the Obama administration and developing the show at the beginning while that was still going on. Was it harder to be a progressive comedian in the Obama administration, or was there still plenty to critique and make fun of?
No, I mean, I think the Obama administration is why I became more political in my act, because every day there was a black man on television who I felt like was not being treated fairly. So as a black man who sometimes is on television at the time, I was like, I can try to do something about this. And so I don't know that if the presidency had, you know, I can't remember even who, if Mitt Romney had won, or, you know, whoever he else he was running against. History is moved so quickly now, it's hard to remember 8 years ago.
Exactly.
But yeah, that if Obama hadn't won, maybe I don't think I'm the comedian I am right now.
Right. Well, there's also sort of something misguided, particularly on the left, too, about the interpretation of the Obama presidency, and that it sort of represented some sort of deliverance into the promised land, that all was fixed, right? But in case that indeed that was not the case.
No, and I think that when I think the last Obama joke I'll ever write is in my Netflix special. We'll see. He's been sort of quiet right now. But, you know, so it's really about that thing about, like, the feeling of, like, loving him and wanting to support him while at the same time being critical of him, you know. But there's so much criticism of him that is based in nothing other than racism and nonsense. And so that feels more important to speak out against more than sometimes the actual critical ideas I have against his policies and his leadership.
Right. A lot of people have called your comedy the perfect antidote to the Trump presidency. Does that feel limiting or inspiring?
I mean, the Trump presidency, as much as we don't realize that, is just a moment in time. So I don't.
Yeah, it's hard to remember that.
Yeah, I think I'll be doing comedy longer than Trump's the president, I think. I mean, you know, things move pretty quickly now, and he certainly has some ideas, and we don't really seem to have a political class on the left or the right who wants to stand up against him. But I think it's only going to last at the most 6 more years.
We can only hope. Let's talk about your new Netflix special, A Private School Negro. Why did you call it that?
Because I wanted to hear a public radio host say it
again and again.
It's been good to hear you say it over and over again. My last special was called Semi-Prominent Negro. I was born in 73, really sort of post the civil rights era. So, but in my household, my mom still talked about it a lot and had friends over and talked about it a lot. And so I heard the word Negro a lot as a kid. And I just have a connection to the word Negro. It's like that's when black people got angry and got loud and got political. And not that black people weren't always angry, loud, and political, but it was a time where there was real organization on a national level to make our voices heard. You know, I don't have to quote Martin Luther King Jr. to convince you of that, hopefully.
You talk about your mom a lot in comedy. What's she like?
She's a hero. She's like, you know, when people meet my mom, they want her to be their, they want her to be their mom. I mean, everybody of my friends on Facebook will tell me when my mom likes their comments or comments on their feed. So my mom was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. She was born in the middle of segregation. She was bused to school. She was like put in remedial English class, in remedial classes in high school because she hadn't been educated, but she was a really smart person and ended up going to Stanford. So, you know, she just, it's a classic story, and it's not that different from many black people in this country of like having to do for yourself because you couldn't trust other people to do for you. And so she's my hero, but she's not that different from many black women in this country.
So what's the Netflix special about?
The Netflix special is really, it's about making the personal political and the political personal and connecting those things through my kids. Like, there's two things that happened that made me the comedian I am today. One is Barack Obama's election, and the other is having kids. And so talking about politics is always pointing on the outside world, and talking about politics is easy, but I want to talk about how politics actually affects my inside world. And so there's really the special is about, it sort of opens and closes on me talking about my kids and also making it clear that my kids are aware of the political era we are in too, even though they're 7 and 3 and a half.
Right. Well, so you spend a lot of time in the show unpacking and defining racism. What are some of the most common arguments people use to claim that someone isn't racist?
That they didn't own slaves.
Right.
I think is probably the number one argument. I didn't own slaves, so why are you complaining about it? I think there's an idea that you can somehow, that I think people think of history as a series of dots and dashes and not one like sort of unbreakable line. And I think that that's what it is. And so whether or not you owned any people or not in your recent history, the fact that people did own people and how they were taken advantage of and how this country's wealth was built on that affects everybody in this country either negatively or positively.
Well, and then there's the physical proximity argument, which you have some words for. We actually have a clip about that we'll play.
Some white man on Twitter tweeted this out. He had a blue check mark, so he's an actual white man. Not a Russian bot man. It was an actual white man. Tweeted out a picture of Donald Trump talking to a black man. And he goes, look how close Donald is standing to this black man. A racist would never do that. That's not how racism works. It's never been about proximity. Literally never. How would they have gotten black people on the boats in Africa? Get on the boat! No, I can't be close to you because I want you to know I'm definitely a racist. Get on the boat! It's not about how close you are to a black person. Thomas Jefferson was real close to black people, you know what I'm saying?
I am in the same room with black people, therefore I am not racist. Doesn't hold water, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think that, you know, it's pretty easy to make fun of people's tweets, but every now and again you go, that tweet crystallizes an argument that a lot of white people have. They just wouldn't say it in that way. But yeah, I just think, and I appreciate you getting all the way through the Thomas Jefferson. Thank you very much.
Well, so you said there were a couple of main things that have really defined your career, Obama's election one being one of them, and being a father, another one. You have a third daughter now too, right? Or one on the way? Or am
no,
I?
I have a third daughter. She's 3 weeks old today. So happy
birthday! Wow! Congratulations. Yeah. So you say that you can tell when things are not right in the White House. What do you mean by that?
Kids absorb a lot of information. Also, our kids live in the Bay Area, in the East Bay. So they're in a very political place, so they're hearing things, and they've been to marches and rallies, and also they're just surrounded by, I would say, we per pound, they're surrounded by more woke people than your average 7 and 3.5 year old. So, I mean, like my daughter Sammy, just at one point, started to talk about President Trump or Donald Trump when he was running for president. And I was like, I don't know where she's getting this from, but she's pretty dead on. She was like, she just said out of nowhere, I don't like his rules. This is when he was a candidate. Right. I was like, that's a pretty good synthesis of what's wrong with Donald Trump. He has bad rules. So, and then at that point, realizing that she had some sort of basic type of knowledge about it, we just sort of encouraged conversation about Trump. And our 3.5-year-old is, she just looks at the TV and goes, bad president.
Right.
Because she's 3.5. We haven't gotten deeper than that. But it's just, they clearly know that this president is not making their friends and family happy or feel good.
So, and your wife is white. How do you talk about race in your household?
The way we talk about, changing diapers.
Like
we
right. just,
it's life. Just, it's just part of the conversation. It's just part of life. It comes up when it needs to come up, and it doesn't come up when it doesn't. I mean, you know, my wife is an academic. She's got a PhD. She's MFA. So she's used to rigorous discussions about things. So our whole life together, since we started dating 15 years ago, has been about talking about things. And so for me, I feel like my wife sort of made me understand feminism better, and mm-hmm. I've helped my wife understand racism better. It's just that's kind of how we flirted, was talking about racism and feminism.
you joke that in your house, white supremacy has been turned on its head. Black is good and white is bad. Your daughters have different skin tones. You say white people tend to assume Juno is white. Do you have different concerns for your daughters because of how they present racially?
I mean, it's just a thing you have to be aware of. Like, you have to be sort of turned on about. Like, if you're in the same way that if your kid is shorter than other kids, you sort of have to be aware of what that means. If your kid is a different size than what people think most other kids are, you have to be. Parents are just aware of how their kids are not fitting into the world the way that the world expects people to fit in. So I don't have any sort of trepidation about it. I also feel pretty lucky about it, because again, we live in the East Bay, so there's no lack of mixed race people around them to sort of talk when they get to a point where they want to talk about it. And if their parents don't understand, because as we know, parents just don't understand, thank you, Will Smith, that they will be able to reach out to people around them. Like, they have like aunties and uncles who
right.
will be able to talk to them about it.
So after the Starbucks arrest of two black men in Philadelphia, you shared your own story of being targeted by a cafe in Berkeley. What happened there?
It was called the Elmwood Cafe. It is closed and reopened as Bakers and Commons, but it's still the same building and same decoration. But me, I went there to talk to my wife. My wife was there with our then 13-week-old baby, Juno, and her friends, who were all white, and they were all holding their newborn babies. It was a mom's group. It was about four of them. And I went up to sort of say hello to my wife and meet her new friends. And at that moment, one of the workers in the cafe knocked on the window and looked at me and basically said, "Get out of here," from inside the cafe. We were outside the cafe sitting at a cafe table. And because they thought I was harassing this table of white women and their white babies, because they said apparently a customer had complained about it. So me and my wife immediately got up and left and talked. And my wife talked to somebody at the cafe about it and told them it was racist. And they said, "No, I think we thought he was selling something. We don't think it was racism." And we turned it into a public event where we had a community meeting about it and brought the community together in a middle school gymnasium. And the cafe owner, Michael Pierce, promised to do a lot of things to change racism. He admitted it was racism. I hear people say allegedly racist, but he admitted it was racism. But then after the heat went away, he just went back to business as usual. And so when that was in about 3.5 years ago. So when the Starbucks thing happened, as people were talking about, "Oh my God, I can't believe racism happened in that one coffee shop," it just made me go, wait a minute. Again, history is not a series of dots and dashes. It is a line, an unbreakable line. There's racism everywhere, including with me in coffee shops. So I just felt like I had to tell my story as a way to again, alert people, mostly white people, to the fact that like racism is happening all the time. You're just only hearing about it sometimes.
Right. Well, you've talked in the past about the fear of not being, quote, black enough. How does that affect how you parent? Or and how you live your life generally?
I mean, I think my fear of not being black enough probably ended when I was my early 20s. Like at some point, right. You just go, this is who I am. So And then having kids, you sort of only like, I'm only worried about the things that directly relate to the health and welfare of my children. So if, now when black people occasionally on Twitter or online or somewhere say I'm not black enough for whatever reason, a lot of times it's because I'm married to a white woman. I don't have time to engage in that argument because are you going to help me raise my kids? If not, if you're going to help me raise my kids, I'll listen to your argument. But if not, I got to keep it moving. So for me, again, luckily my kids live in a time where they're going to grow up with the internet just as being a normal thing. If I, when I was a kid, if I'd had the internet, I could have reached out and found other black kids who felt similarly to me, but I felt like I was the only black kid in the world who liked the band Living Color or the band Fishbone. Whereas my kids will be able to grow up, and not only are they in a more racially mixed environment than I was, and they will also be able to get online and find people who are like-minded. And I think so there will be a sense that they're not going to be so alone, which I think is great.
Right. Your family is featured in your other work in the United States, Shades of America. You bring your divorced parents together and do DNA tests to figure out your family history. What was the impetus for this?
You know, there's always talk about, like, do you want to find your, you know, take the DNA test and find out who you are? And I got, and the people at Ancestry reached out to me and said, would you like to do that? And would you, I think I would have said no, but then it was like, do you want to make something with it? Do you want to film it? And I was like, I like doing things that I feel like if I know other people are going to see them and it's going to, and maybe it'll help other people understand. I was like, yes, my resting rate is really, I'd rather just be on the couch. But when there's interesting work to be made, I get up off the couch. So I decided to, you know, and then it became like, well, it's not just about what my DNA says about me or what my family story tells me about me. It's about what it tells my parents. Right. And so it really felt like natural to put them in there. And my parents are not shy of the camera, as you can see if you watch the videos on CNN. So it was really a fun time. And it was also a fun time to get my parents together because they hadn't been together since my wedding and they're not normally in the same room together.
So what surprised you most about that experience?
What surprised me most about that experience? You know, there's family stories that you can find out from taking those DNA tests like we did Ancestry.com. And so we got to find out, like, for example, that we had always had this narrative on my dad's side that there was a white slave owner who basically had sexual relations with a slave named Francis Bell, and that was our family came from that, like from this white slave owner having kids with Francis Bell. And they had like 13 kids together. Not all of them survived to adulthood, but they had 13 kids together. So it was like it was sort of a strange idea of like, why would the slave owner have 13 kids with this enslaved black woman? And we found out that he wasn't a slave owner, that he was just some dude, as I call him. It takes, slavery's painful, and we certainly come from people who are owned by people, but they find out that this one white man that we had sort of cast in this role of the slave owner was not a slave owner. It just changes the narrative. Doesn't mean he was a great person, but it just changes the narrative. So things like that was a pretty shocking piece of information.
CRISPR understanding of your own history. I'm speaking with writer and comedian W. Kamau Bell about his debut Netflix special titled W. Kamau Bell, Private School Negro. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Emmy Award winner W. Kamau Bell about all of his work, including the Netflix special W. Kamau Bell, Private School Negro. Let's talk about free speech. Berkeley has gotten a lot of attention as a battleground for free speech. What's your take on that debate?
I mean, I talk about it in the special. This is not a very original thought. I want to be clear about that. But you have the freedom from speech. You have the freedom of speech in this country, but you don't have the freedom from consequences. And I think that a lot of times people think that because Berkeley is fighting back against what we would define as hate speech, that we're somehow not allowing free speech. No, it's just that free speech not only goes both directions, it goes in all directions at the same time. So, you know, I'm a big fan of free speech. As a comedian, my career thrives on free speech. But if I tell a joke that somehow offends the wrong person at the wrong time or somehow actually looks like it is connected to encouraging violence, then I have to deal with those consequences.
And sometimes it feels like this sort of quote-unquote debate about free speech, it feels more like a performance, no?
I mean, what do you mean as a performance? How do you mean?
Well, just in terms of some of the sort of intentional button pushing as opposed to sort of trying to generate real conversation.
Yes, that's true. It used to be that like trolling was something for the editorial page of the newspaper, and you only went there if you actually wanted to feel angered by what people's opinions were. But now we have turned trolling into a whole professional class of people. So like
exactly.
It's just, you know, social media runs on people trolling each other and sort of trying to start problems. And yes, Berkeley became, I think at some point the alt-right decided that Berkeley was a good place to professionally troll people, a la Milo and Ann Coulter and all those other people. And what they found out is that once Berkeley realized, oh, you're going to come here all the time? Well, we have backup called the rest of the Bay Area that will come show up if you're gonna make your faces known here. So I think that they were surprised that, I mean, it happened all over the country when the alt-right really decided to show up in these cities and troll like Boston. That when those cities realized it was a real thing, they're like, okay, well, then we'll show up to make it clear that you're not welcome here.
Right. We actually have a clip from your show that pertains to this I want to play.
And that's why I hate the fake argument about free speech. No, you have the freedom of speech, but what you don't have is the freedom of consequences from that speech. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. You can say whatever you want to say. Whatever you want to say. But if your free speech causes riots, you have to deal with the consequences of that. If everywhere you go, people riot after you speak, guess what? You got to deal with that. If everywhere I did comedy, a riot broke out, we wouldn't be here right now. We'd be on YouTube with this.
The consequences is very important. It almost feels like the alt-right's version of dealing with that, as you put it, is to arm themselves.
Well, I think that there, I mean, all of this comes from, and, you know, there's way smarter people than me that can talk about this, but I think about, you know, all of this comes from, and where this idea scares people, white people on all sides, even people, white people who agree with me, the idea of white privilege, that you're sort of, that no matter how low you are, your station is in this country, no matter how poor you are, or how poorly educated you are, how bad your circumstances are, there is a sense that because I'm white, things are going better for me than they are going for black people or people of color. And I think that, like, a lot of the alt-right anger is about that. That, like, I hate when it's not, when things aren't going well for me, so it's got to be somebody else's fault other than mine or my community's fault. So it's got to be black people's fault or trans people's fault or you know, openly gay people's fault sometimes. It's just like, it can't just be my fault.
Right. So obviously you don't buy the free speech arguments of, say, you know, Ann Coulter, but do you think that progressives are bad sometimes?
I don't buy much of Ann Coulter. Let me be clear about that. Not the books, none of it.
Do you think that, point taken, but do you think in a general sense, progressives, people on the left, are bad at listening to opinions from others that don't necessarily agree with them?
I mean, I think people in general are bad at listening to people who don't agree. I think there's, you know, I think that there's I talk about this in the special, that the one of the challenges of America is that everybody lives in their corner. And if you love the corner you live in, sometimes what that means is that you start to think the people who don't live in your corner are doing America wrong. And that happens in Berkeley, like Berkeley condescends to places that aren't Berkeley. But it also happens in Alabama, in Mobile, Alabama, where they condescend to, when I go to Mobile, Alabama, which I go regularly because my dad lives there, and I go, where are you guys from? And they say, where are you from? And I say, Berkeley. They're like, Berkeley? And if I say in Berkeley, I'm going to go visit my dad in Mobile, Alabama, they go, Mobile, Alabama?
Right.
So that's a problem on all sides. And I think the faster we get away from this, the idea that there's two sides of things, like, you know, even in the political spectrum, the faster we get away from that and understand that a lot of this is human stuff, that we will be, I think we'll get to the solutions quicker.
We're obviously, you know, going to visit your dad in Mobile opens your eyes to things. But in general terms, do you have strategies you employ for getting out of these echo chambers?
You know, it's funny. I work at CNN, and I've talked about this a little bit. And, you know, but when I think about Anthony Bourdain, who passed away a few weeks ago, the name of his show was Parts Unknown. Mm-hmm. And on Bourdain's show, it was about going to all over the globe to find different parts unknown, quote unquote. And the thing I think about with that show, now that he's gone, especially people are like, oh, yeah, he took me places I'd never been before. And I feel like you can probably do that in your own city. You right. know, there are parts unknown in your neighborhood.
Right. So, like, very good point.
That the more of us who sort of, and I think I just do this by matter of course. I moved around a lot as a kid. It's my job. I travel around a lot. But the more you sort of get out of your bubble, you don't have to go to Singapore or someplace far away from you. You don't have to get on a plane. You can probably walk down the street and instead of turning right at the corner, turn left on the corner and get to parts unknown. So I think that's what we need to do. And I think people think they have to go visit, like people in the West Coast have to go visit Trump voters in Virginia. No, no, no. Just walk around your neighborhood. Go to different places in your neighborhood you don't go.
Yeah. No, it's a very good point. I mean, I think oftentimes we obsess about sort of the resources it takes to get across the world to see something new that way. But in fact, it's very often right under your nose. I'm curious about how your notions of free speech relate to your role as a provocative political comedian. Isn't part of your job to make people sort of uncomfortable? No.
Yeah, I mean my job is to get laughs, and then it's about how do you get those laughs. And I happen to enjoy laughs that have a little bit of like, uh-oh. Like, that just happens to be how I like to get down. Not every comedian likes that, you know. Jim Gaffigan's an incredible genius, and I don't think he's necessarily trying to get laughs from making people sort of go, uh-oh, and yet he's one of the greats of all time. So I think it's about how you get there. But for me, the thing that is important to me is that I'm only stepping on the toes of the people whose toes I want to step on. And I think that's the thing I'm really taking on, is that I try not to tell a joke about one group and make fun of a group that doesn't need to be made fun of in the process of making fun of the original group. So for me, it's about making sure that being very strategic about whose toes you step on and why you step on it, and making it clear why you're stepping on toes. I'm not just sort of like, I think sometimes comedy can be sort of like, you know, it's just sort of like comedians are just sort of throwing whatever's out there, whatever words come to their head or where they think is funny, and not worried about the consequences. But I'm always thinking about the consequences. It doesn't mean I don't want to offend people. I only want to offend the people that I want to offend.
So who do you want to offend?
People who have made it their life's work or their vocation or their avocation to not take in not taking the opinions of others and not taking new information, and also who lives require the oppression of other people for them to be successful.
You have a lot of white fans. Do you think their enjoyment of your that's my segue. Do you like that?
That's a good segue. I have a lot of white family members because of my
that's
wife.
True.
I got a lot of white kind of
wife. Do you think your white fans, their enjoyment of your comedy helps some of them deal with race in a new way, or does laughing about white supremacy give white people an easy way to feel like they're quote unquote woke?
I mean, you can't necessarily control what people do with the information once you give it to them. I mean, this is true of, like, you know, I remember, you know, raging. I interviewed Tom Morello on my first TV show, Totally Biased, and we talked about the fact that Paul Ryan, Senator Paul Ryan, his favorite band, he said, was Rage Against the Machine. And Tom Morello was like, I don't know how he's listening to it, but that's, we should not be his favorite band. And I feel the same way. It's like, you can't necessarily control what people do with the work, but what you can do is make sure you're putting all of yourself into it and try to be as clear as possible. Now, I will say this, I regularly hear from people when I'm in airports or online, white people, and I hear from all sorts of people, but we're just talking about white people right now. It's time we finally talk about white people. That I hear from people who are like, "Oh my God, you're opening up so many perspectives for me I didn't have." Or this is the other thing: you're helping me talk to my conservative uncle, mother, father, brother, who I normally don't talk to, and they sit down and watch your show, and we watch it together, and it gives us the ability to talk, which we don't normally have. So for me, it's like, I hear that.
I can't imagine there's a more rewarding comment to receive.
No, there isn't. I mean, I think the thing that I'm learning about, and I didn't know this about the show, is that people watch it as part of a group. Like, either a family will watch it together, and I hear this all the time. Like parents and their kids, like little kids, will watch the show together, and they will talk about what they saw, or that people will sit down with that relative they normally talk to, or then discuss the show. And so for me, I didn't know that, but that definitely makes me feel like the work has meaning. So, you know, sometimes you get the ratings and you're like, oh, this show didn't rate very well. But you're like, yeah, but the show's going to exist for a long time and people will still be able to go back to it and find the work valuable.
The Me Too movement has forced us to rethink the lines between sexual joke and harassment. This is something you've been trying to navigate for years, no?
I mean, I mean, this goes back to what I said earlier about stepping on the
right
toes of people step on. So I certainly had jokes earlier in my career where, you know, in the middle of a political joke, I would say something that was sexist or misogynistic. And then I had a friend, Martha Reinberg, who I've talked about a lot, who pulled me aside. It was like, you can't end racism and make sexism worse. And so, like, I was like, what do you mean? And she went through my act and showed it to me. So I've been trying to do that work for a long time. So for me, I feel, because I just don't want pushback from the people I also would like support from. And I think that's the way I feel about it. When I go and perform and do shows, and that's why we did the Netflix special in the round, so you can see the audience. There's a variety of races, ages, ethnicities in the room, and I like that.
Yeah.
So that means that, like, and also it's very split across gender lines, and I like that. And I want that to be the case. I think if you start stepping on the wrong toes, your audience starts to thin out. I think about somebody like Sam Kinison, who early in his career was really thought as like a sort of progressive. We didn't have the word back then, but that was what he was thought of, as sort of this progressive, forward-thinking person. And then when he started like mud wrestling Jessica Hahn on stage, his audience changed.
Right.
And I think about that time, like, I want my audience to be the people I want to hang out with.
Right. Well, you just wrapped up season 4 of United Shades of Anxiety. Sorry, United Shades of America. And you're figuring out where to go next season. What are the questions guiding you right now as you think about race and culture in the U.S.?
you know, I think we look at the news and we feel like if ever there's people in the news who are not getting a fair shake, we sort of feel like the news is giving us homework assignments. And I think that the great thing about the show is that now that the word is out, we're hearing from people about places we should go and people we should talk to. And I think this country has been around for over 200 years, and I think there's probably 200 seasons of United Shades in us, just sort of like trying to clear this up and make this and sort of help people out. So it's really just about like how do people who currently in this country feel like they are experiencing oppression that they've never felt before in a more harsh way? How do we get them the microphone so they can make clear what they're going through?
And you have a book coming out this summer, yes? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's actually the paperback of my book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell. So the hardback came out last year, but now the paperback's coming out, so my fans can buy it because they can't afford hardback books. it's called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, and it was written right in the throes of the election. So it'll take you back to a very key time in America's history, but it also then talks about how I got to be who I am and the story of like Martha Reinberg explaining to me, you can't be racist if you're going to be sex. You can't end racism and make sexism worse. Stories like that are in the book about how I got to be the comedian and person that I am, and dad that I am.
So much of your work is performative, being on stage, being in front of the cameras. What was it like, the experience of sitting down and writing a book?
One of the most painful things in my life. And, they're going to have to back the money truck up really big for me to do it again, which I don't think they're going to do. I just think that it was super hard, because the hardest part is that because you have to include other people's stories in there. And you, at some point, I'd let my wife read part of it and she'd be like, that's not how that happened. And she would give me information that I was like, oh yeah, you're right, I forgot about that. And it sort of feels unfair in some level you're codifying something by putting it in a book and you don't really get everybody's opinions in it who are actually involved in the book, especially when you're writing autobiography.
Well, I know United Shades is taking up a lot of your time, but are you itching to do another special soon?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to figure out how to do like I in the UK comedians do specials every year, but I don't think I could do that. But I would love to be able to be on that every 18 months to 2 year plan. So now that the Netflix special Private School Negro is out, I basically start from square one again of building a new hour, which is an exciting and scary place to be in.
Right, right. Well, it's a wonder that you have any time to sleep between all of the work, but it's fantastic work, and I'm so grateful to have you here to talk about it today. Thanks for joining me so much.
Thanks, and why would you assume I sleep?
Why sleep? You can do that when you're dead, of course. I've been speaking with writer and comedian W. Kamau Bell about his debut Netflix special titled One More Time with Emotion, W. Kamau Bell, Private School Negro.